What sent British women of the 19th century off to India in search of husbands, and what kind of lives did they lead once they got there? Elida Becker joins us to talk about her review of Anne de Courcy's new book, The Fishing Fleet, Husband Hunting in the Raj.
So suddenly a woman would find herself off in the hills in a bungalow somewhere, and she was married.
Should you eat meat, not eat meat? Nick Redding may offer a clue when he joins us to talk about two books he's reviewed this week, The Meat Racket by Christopher Leonard and In Meat We Trust by Maureen Ogle.
All of the same arguments that we have today are exactly the same ones that they were having in 1890 when Gustavus Swift first cornered the dressed beef market in downtown Manhattan.
Julie Bosman will be here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Elida Becker, who is a staff editor at the Book Review, joins us now to talk about her review of The Fishing Fleet, with the intriguing subtitle Husband Hunting in the Raj by Anne de Courcy. Hi, Elida.
Hi, good morning.
So you reviewed this in this week's issue. Tell us about what The Fishing Fleet is.
Well, it began in the very early days of the East India Company, when there were gentlemen from England working there and marrying into the local families, and the company figured this was not such a good thing. And they actually paid young women to go over to India, and they had a year to marry the first likely suspect.
Provide company
find.
And heirs and
exactly,
caretaking and
exactly.
all of that.
And it was a rather commercial transaction. I mean, these were, you know, it was an era when if you weren't married, that was a terrible tragedy. So there were quite a number of prospects. But as the East India Company gradually ceded power to the British Raj, and it became a much more popular destination, it actually switched.
And for those in need of a husband.
Yes. And instead of paying women to go over, women were paying to get on a ship and go over. And they sometimes had just several weeks of church appearances and carefully monitored social events to find a husband. These men would come in. I mean, the ones who lived in the cities obviously had much more time to check out the crop. But the ones who were posted to remote places sometimes had just a few weeks to find a proper bride. And so suddenly a woman would find herself off in the hills in a bungalow somewhere, and she was married, but that was about it.
So. Wow. So let's talk first about the early days. Who were these women who were, you know, recruited and paid to go over there? I mean, was this sort of the dregs of the unmarried women? What class were they?
Well, I think they were probably not the dregs, but they were, you know, the sisters who otherwise would have been shunted off to auntie in the countryside or that, you know, that kind of thing. That was at least there was a social aspect to it.
And who were the women who paid to go over there?
They were of families that could afford that.
Right.
And as more and more men took up service with the army and with the company, they had relatives. So there would be sisters and cousins and, you know, unmarried ladies who had not been able to find a spouse back home.
Right, so the third daughter kind of thing.
Exactly. And then they would be taken in by ladies who were already established there, and they would find a husband among the men who were 30 and older, because you were not allowed to marry, or they were highly discouraged from marrying men before the men were before the age of 30, because they were considered not to be able to support a family by then.
But the women were considerably younger.
They were much younger because obviously your shelf life as a potential bride was pretty limited. And so in a funny kind of way, that reflected the patriarchy that was already established with the Raj, you know, the attitude of the British towards the Indians was reflected again in the attitude of the husbands and the wives. And it was a very, very strict hierarchy, and the husbands were the dominant force, and the women were expected to toe the line pretty severely.
So. And how orchestrated was this little courtship period?
Oh, I think it varied, you know. And as time went on, it got, you know, on into the 20th century, it got very loose indeed.
But held balls and sort of events.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, wherever there was a kind of safe social setting where people were not going to be going off in twos and doing illicit things.
And how did Anne de Courcy go about finding these women whom she profiles in the book?
Well, I think she has written a number of other books about India and the British aristocracy, and I think it's quite clear she had a lot of material that that seemed tempting enough to put into another book. And there are a lot of interviews that she's done with people who are elderly now, but who were there in the 20s and 30s, and material from families that she's collected. There are a number of chapters in the book that are devoted to particular women. Mm-hmm. And those stories are quite interesting because then you get to follow them all the way through.
And did the families tend to stay in India?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But they always sent the children back to be educated. So you got this constant back and forth. And it's quite sad in some of these chapters, talking about the wives who have to send their children off at the age of, you know, very quite early ages to be educated or taken in by family members because it wasn't considered safe for children to be growing up in the climate of India. And
right.
Also, they needed to be formally educated. So they'd be without contact with their children for years on end.
And often lonely to begin with.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily totally safe for them all the time either.
Oh, no. No, no. I mean, it's the contrast is interesting. The women who were in the cities and were sort of more aristocratically connected had very glamorous lives. I mean, going to visit Maharajas and walking on carpets made of pearls and all kinds of exotic stuff. But if you were married to a fellow who was running an outpost somewhere way off on the borders, you could be alone for days, weeks at a time. You had to order all of your supplies, you know, months and months ahead. And you were essentially alone and also in quite primitive conditions.
You mentioned in your review that, you know, these women had many, many servants and often sort of were deprived of any kind of purpose.
Yeah, it's interesting.
In their own house.
She would be alone, but she would also be surrounded by servants. So she was alone, but not alone. The aspect of the servants is very interesting because they all seem to coordinate on their own. There's a very funny little bit where de Courcy talks about the expectation that all of these wives would have to entertain. But they arrived and they had almost no household furnishings. And so they would go out to a dinner at someone's house and look down and see, was that the plate from my kitchen? The servants all shared the utensils. And then they would, scurry back and bring it back the next morning. So.
How well did or how strictly did the women sort of follow these very prescribed roles? I mean, were there divorces? Did any women sort of veer off campus and intermarry with the Indians?
That was highly discouraged. There is one story in de Courcy's book about a young woman who married a Maharaja. And obviously the Maharaja had a life.
Okay.
That one was okay. Well, there were still aspects of that were not okay, but she got away with it. And I'm, you know, she doesn't dwell on this aspect of it, but I'm sure that there were. And she also talks about the hill stations where people would go to escape the heat in the summertime and where the strictures were rather looser. And things happened that were sort of known about but not talked about. So, you
know. And what about divorce? What about when this didn't work out?
I don't recall that there's any much discussion of this. Mm-hmm. I mean, because up until fairly recently, divorce was, you know,
verboten,
yeah.
Did any of them not find a husband and have to sort of ship back?
Oh, sure, yeah. And in the early days, they were called returned empties, which was sort of the height of indignity.
Charming.
If you couldn't find somebody, you were really, really either wildly fussy or totally impossible yourself. So,
well, it sounds like a fascinating book, a lot of fun, and some terrific photographs in it, but also a very important part of women's history that many people probably are not aware of. So thank you, Elida.
Thank you.
That was Elida Becker, an editor at The Book Review, talking about her review of Anne de Courcy's The Fishing Fleet, Husband Hunting in the Raj. Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So we are going to talk about an interesting author, book in the works.
Planned book at this point.
Planned book. Tell us about G.S. Elevator.
So G.S. Elevator, the G.S. stands for Goldman Sachs, was born as a Twitter feed a few years ago. And the Twitter feed consisted of so-called overheard quotes that were purportedly heard inside the elevators at Goldman Sachs. Now, it was really funny. It was really sexist and racist and mean. And
because those things are so funny always.
All kinds of quips that you can imagine come from the mouths of overprivileged bankers at Goldman. But this Twitter feed gained a pretty solid following. I think it has just over 600,000 followers at the moment. And it was so popular that in the last few months, it became a book proposal. And last month, Touchstone, an imprint of Simon & Schuster, bought the book. Now, it's worth noting that the book itself is not a simple reproduction of the Twitter feed. It's not a little joke, gifty book that, you know, you see on the counter when you check out at the bookstore. The book, as it was described by Touchstone, is true tales of deviance and excess in the world of investment banking. So this is really a nonfiction account of what Wall Street culture is really like by the author of this Twitter feed, who until now has remained anonymous.
Now, it turns out that the true tale aspect and the nonfiction aspect are called into question because the author was unmasked.
This week, our colleague Andrew Sorkin wrote a front page story unmasking the writer of the Twitter feed. His name is John Lefebvre. He lives in Texas. And
he is not indeed riding the elevators of Goldman Sachs.
Exactly. He did work on Wall Street. He worked for Citigroup for 7 years. But contrary to his previous statements, he never did work at Goldman. So that is a pretty major strike against this author's credibility right there. Now, a lot of people have responded to this by saying, look, it's just a Twitter feed. No one really believed that it was real. You know, we accept on the internet that people make stuff up. But the question became, as Touchstone said, look, we're still going to publish this book. Should that standard of truth also be the standard of truth for what goes into a book?
And there was also a lot of real fuzzing of lines here with the author, who was offered a job at Goldman but never took it, and in his proposal identified himself as having been offered a job at Goldman, and then I think next sentence gone on to work in whatever aspect of finance he did work at somewhere else. It's rather misleading, isn't it?
It is misleading, and a lot of publishers who saw the proposal also described it as misleading. Now, from what I understand about the author and his connection to Goldman, it goes like this. He did accept a job at Goldman, so he did interview. He went through the interview process. He accepted a job. The job was announced in a press release, and then the author, who at that point was on what's called gardening leave from a different firm, so what he thought was a few months that he was not allowed to work, so sort of a non-compete clause in his previous contract. It actually turned out to indicate that he could not accept a job with a competing bank. So even though he accepted the job and it was announced that he took the job, he never started working at Goldman. He never showed up for work. He never had an office. He never got a paycheck. He didn't work at Goldman. So that is pretty clear cut.
What has his response been to Andrew Sorkin's revealing his identity?
Well, he said that he has always expected that he would be unmasked. So he's played it pretty cool. Simon & Schuster, Touchstone, the imprint of Simon & Schuster that acquired the book, has said that they plan to go forward. And the agent for Mr. Lefebvre, Bird Level, has also pushed back and said, look, it's just a Twitter feed. And there is that feeling that he really didn't do anything wrong.
Right.
Now, it's also worth pointing out that in an interview in 2011 with the New York Times, when asked directly, do you work at Goldman? He said, yes, and explained in great detail what part of Goldman he works in, which was an utter lie.
All right. Heading to nonfiction shelves then, probably sometime next year. Thanks, Julie.
Actually, this year.
This year. Okay.
This October, if all goes well.
If you want to know what really happens at Goldman Sachs. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks.
Nick Redding joins us now. He is the author of Methland, and in this week's issue reviews two books about meat: The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business by Christopher Leonard, and In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America by Maureen Ogle. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. These two books coming out at roughly the same time on what seems to be the same subject, but they're different books. Can you characterize each one briefly and what sort of distinguishes the two?
I think the primary thing that distinguishes the two approaches is that one is pretty straightforward journalism, that being The Meat Racket, which is it's essentially the story of Tyson Foods, and not just the story of the company and where it comes from, but the sort of historical window and economic window in recent American history into which that company and how it functions and how it took over the meat business, how that fits into it. And it's sort of, by the time you've read the book, you sort of come out against Tyson. And on the other hand, In Meat We Trust is more of a cultural history that says, from the very beginning, it says, you know, whoa, let's not say food is good or bad. Let's not say corporations are good and bad. Let's look very carefully at the history of meat and primarily of the stock business in America, and then we'll judge. And that book, at the end, sort of comes out on the other side, which is to say, if not necessarily pro big food, then certainly not anti big food.
It sounds like also In Meat We Trust is more about consumption and The Meat Racket is more about the production side of meat.
It is, but you know, part of the argument that In Meat We Trust makes is built very much on individual and company history as it regards food production. And so, you know, it goes a lot into the history of Swift and Armour as an example, which those two companies kind of laid the genetic code onto which Tyson from which Tyson was ultimately.
Now, Christopher Leonard, the author of The Meat Racket, he's a journalist, a former agribusiness reporter for the AP. Did he have good access to Tyson? Was he meeting with the executives of the firm? Did he have access to the factories, to the slaughterhouses?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, I think this is the thing that makes The Meat Racket unique in kind of the history of books, of American books about, you know, big food, is that the whole story is told from the inside. I mean, so the guy he spent a decade as the head agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press, and in that time, he had access to everybody. In fact, he had one of the last known interviews with Don Tyson, and, you know, many of the executives at the company, many of the farmers who were put out of business. It's really a remarkable book in that way.
And in Meet We Trust, Maureen Ogle is an historian and looks at the history of carnivore America, America's sort of meat-eating habits and ways of producing meat from the earliest days.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I found most interesting about the book is that a lot of the stuff that we discuss today in terms of, you know, is meat good for us? Is the meat business good for our economy? And is it good for us sociologically and culturally? And all of the same arguments that we have today are exactly the same ones that they were having in 1890 when Gustavus Swift first kind of cornered the dressed beef market in downtown Manhattan. And, you know, people were very upset. Why? Because it put a lot of butchers out of business. It put the small guy out of business. And everybody was deeply conflicted about that. And so it's just, it's interesting historical perspective. You know, it's sort of easy to imagine that this is the first time we've been fighting over this big stuff, and it's
right.
Not.
Looking at this sort of subject historically, the first book that I think comes to most people's mind is, of course, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. What has changed since then? And do either of the authors discuss that book?
Maureen Ogle does. She sort of less discusses The Jungle in some way than she does Upton Sinclair's kind of function in the dialogue at the time. And Upton Sinclair doesn't necessarily come out looking very good in that light. But one of the things that has changed significantly is that in the time of The Jungle, certainly there were these meat trusts. You know, everybody's heard about Roosevelt busting up the trusts, and the meat business was very powerful. But what was more powerful then were the railroads. And the railroads essentially were able to control the American food business because they controlled not production, but distribution and to some level retail. So they were able to control two of the three parts of the value chain. And so, you know, that's a stark difference with today, right? I mean, the railroads are kind of a non-player. And it was in some respects a response to the monopoly of the railroads that gave people like Gustavus Swift his start.
When you look at The Jungle, I mean, that expose from a consumer's perspective was very much also about the conditions of these factories and sort of all the horrific things that ended up in your hamburger. But the exposés today, it seems, are much more about not rat's tails and that kind of thing, but the hormones and the chemicals and the odd diets given to the animals that we slaughter. Is that a part of both of these books?
Yeah, it is. I mean, so, you know, both of them go into hormone use and antibiotic use, and they go into detail into what exactly animal feed is made out of, and they talk about the economics of it and why chickens today eat what they eat, as an example. But there again, I mean, there's this kind of dividing line between the books. And in Meat We Trust, in some way, you know, it comes out essentially saying, We do this because it's the most efficient way, and everything about our society and our economy drives us to be more efficient. And what's fascinating about Maureen Ogle's take on it is that if she blames anybody for all of this, she blames the American consumer, who want to have it both ways. And she says very early on, you can't have it both ways. You can't have an expendable economy driven by housing starts and expanding suburbs and urbanization and not have antibiotics in your chicken feed, because otherwise we're not going to have enough chickens. I mean, that's essentially her argument. And then, you know, on the meat racket side, I think Leonard's argument regarding supplements and antibiotics and stuff is that, you know, it's scary, right? I mean, it's kind of scary.
So chatting before the show, you confessed to having had bacon for breakfast.
Did
these books...
And I loved it.
Did either of these books kind of put you off your meal at all?
No, but, you know, at the risk of too much information, I would say that, you know, 90% of the meat that my wife and children and I eat are from things that we've hunted. And so, you know, we kind of get around that question by, that's how we do it. No, they didn't put me off of meat, but they didn't necessarily make me any less a fan of all the venison that's in my freezer either.
Well, I think that your answer is probably a very different answer from most of our listeners who cannot boast of hunting their own meat. Thank you so much, Nick, for joining us and talking about these two books.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
That was Nick Redding. In this week's issue, he reviews two books about meat consumption and production, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business by Christopher Leonard, and In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America by Maureen Ogle. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So lots of books this week? Not a lot? What's going on?
A medium amount of books this week. On the hardcover fiction list, there are four new titles. They're all from people who've been on the list before. Right at the top of the list at number one, J.D. Robb, who her readers well know now is Nora Roberts, has a new book in her Death series. This one's called Concealed in Death. Then at number five, David Weber, a science fiction writer whose Safehold series has sporadically made the list. This is a book called Like a Mighty Army. It's the seventh book in the series and the fourth to show up on the list. It's new at number five, which is the highest ranking that Weber has ever made on the hardcover list. Then new at number 10, J.A. Jantz has a new Allie Reynolds book out. It's called Moving Target. And down at number 15, Alice Hoffman, another longtime bestseller regular, her new novel, The Museum of Extraordinary Things, which is a historical novel set in New York City, where she was born, is new at number 15.
The only one that's not part of a series. You can just read that one if you so choose.
That's right. There are two new titles on the nonfiction list this week, and they're both by writers new to the list. Neither of them has ever had a bestseller before. The first one at number 10 is by a rock journalist, a writer for Guitar Magazine named Alan Paul. And for his whole career, he's really been associated with the Allman Brothers Band as a big fan and as a reporter. And he's hung out with them and written a lot of things about them before. And now he's assembled what's an oral history of the band called One Way Out. It includes interviews with all of the surviving band members and producers and roadies. People like Eric Clapton and Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead are in there. Yeah, so just an oral history of the band, One Way Out. That's new at number 10.
Mm-hmm.
Then new at number 14, a book called Young Money by a reporter named Kevin Roos. He's a reporter now for New York Magazine. He worked earlier in his career for the New York Times. And this book, Young Money, is a profile of eight different young bankers and people in the finance world, kind of following them out of school and into the low-ranking jobs in the finance world to find out what it's like for them in the first couple of years.
Suffering terrible working conditions, horribly low salaries.
In fact, I mean, he looks at the number of hours that they work. The salaries are lower than you would think for people.
Right.
I mean, they're not low, but they're lower than you think when you hear finance workers. These are people who are just starting to climb the ladder. He does look at some people who are at the top of the ladder. One of the things that he did for this book, he sneaked into a meeting of the Kappa Beta Phi fraternity,
right,
which is the big Wall Street fraternity. And that's
just in case it wasn't a fraternity enough already.
Exactly. That is kind of the big secret society that's really the top of the top,
right,
the people who run the banks.
But this book is mostly about the wolf pups.
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.